starting to feel a little like Rav Shaul. All the prayers, I keep hearing my grace is sufficient for you. So I'm praying for more grace. He does answer some prayers. I'm not having to sit down to give the message today, so I see that as a plus. The title of this message is Torah, Tree of Life. Torah is described as Eitz Chaim, Tree of Life. In this rendering, if you look at it in reverse order, coveting is the root of all aberrant behavior. Coveting was the very first sin, enticing Satan to leave God and his desire to be God. Coveting is what first enticed and beguiled the man. Eat this and be like God. It's a decision that he and all generations since have regretted. The trunk of the tree in this illustration would be the mundane instructions guiding the treatment of the physical creation, others of our species, animals, the earth itself. These mundane instructions support, or more properly, reflect those commandments that govern the conduct of our souls and our relationship with God. The leaves, they would be tantamount to the leaves that break out from the shadows and are exposed to the sun, and the light of God is absorbed by the leaves, which make food for those who are following God along this path that Torah prescribes. It is alluded to when Yeshua comes to his disciples. I'm still a little fachatic from yesterday. When the disciples come and see Yeshua, and they say, "Come, Rabbi, eat," and he says, "I have food you don't know about. Food other than food that we would eat physically. It's the food that sustained him for 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, preparing him for his trial." There is one commandment that is of a different essence than the others, and that would be the fourth commandment, the Shabbat. Shabbat is rest and peace, and it is actually a transition from the mundane to the realm of the soul, more ethereal, more delicate realm. Rest, peace. A time that transforms all who enter into that time and space, allowing them to touch eternity. Rest and peace are the two essential conditions necessary to hear God. And when I talk about eternity, if you will read the Genesis account again, you will note that the Shabbat was never closed. We never read Vayehi Erev Vayehi Boker Yom Shevet. And there was evening and morning the seventh day. It was never closed. It was supposed to exist for eternity. That was the condition of creation in God's plan for all eternity. We didn't leave that condition until we ate. We sinned. And as I contemplated this, the beginning of this week, I wrote these words. I sit the waters of eternity in the early light, and I saw things that never were, yet always have been. I got a glimpse of the garden. Nothing I could understand, for I have nothing in my experience that can relate to that, a complete rest a complete peace. For a few moments, I quit the earth. I wasn't here anymore. This rendering of Torah as a tree finds its greatest expression in the tropical rainforest, frankly. While the roots and the trunk exist in dimly lit shadows, the canopies of these lush landscapes are exposed to light. The canopy of the tropical rainforest has its own ecosystem, which is vastly different from that which lives below. The dust of the earth floating on currents of air accumulate in this thick web of branches and leaves. They are watered by the monsoons, the early rains and the late rains. And these fertile fields provide a landscape for the seeds of many different flowering plants to grow. They couldn't grow below. They don't have the light. We have extracted many of the medicines that we use for healing from these very plants that exist in the canopies of these tropical rainforests, which were given by God for the healing of the nations. The illustration is quite accurate. One of the functions of old people is they look back a lot, because when they look forward, there's a lot of pain involved in going forward, so we look back a lot. And as I looked back over the course of my life this week, I gained more perspective. My entire life has been a quest to ascend through the tangled shroud of shadows and break through into the light. The streams of iridescence that filtered through the canopy called to my soul from my earliest moments of consciousness. It bore a witness to a realm that exists beyond what I could see, yet knew was real. It's the whole meaning of the word realm. Realm comes from real. It is a place that is real. I knew it existed, even though I couldn't see it. I saw bits and pieces, evidence of its existence. I knew in the depths of my soul this place existed, that it was a realm of light, a realm of peace, a place I knew intuitively I would find rest. And that realm has called muster on my soul since as far back as I can remember. I have never been content. Paul tells you to be content in everything. I have been content in virtually nothing. Never been content in any place I've ever lived. I was always looking to move on, to find the entrance into this place. I didn't know where it was, but I knew where it wasn't. It wasn't wherever I was. Teton Valley, Idaho, is the only place I have ever called home in this physical realm. I wasn't born there. I was born in the precise opposite environment, Brooklyn, New York. But I never called Brooklyn home. I could never live there. Couldn't wait to get out. When I first got to Teton Valley, Idaho, it's like tension just flowed from me. And I looked at my wife and I said, "We're home. Come home." Of course, now the Idaho of my youth back in the 70s is gone. Last time I went up there, I took the young'uns in the congregation. I went up there and there was what used to be feedlots, and rugged men were replaced by metaphysical bookstores and men in tights reciting Shakespeare. And I like Shakespeare, I do. I just don't want to see men in tights. In the place I first came to, where rugged men armed were herding sheep down the center of Main Street. It just didn't seem right to me. That place is gone. It exists now only in the real and sometimes the contrived memories of that place most glorious, the place I called home. In Idaho, my constant dream was made real one day. I went to climb a mountain. When I broke tree line, I stood before this boulder field which spread out like a sea, and it led to the base of the Grand Teton. And the relatively genteel beauty of the path that led through the trees and the streams paled when I stood before the majesty of that jagged rock. I really have no words to describe what I felt when I broke through the trees and saw this peak. Reached up through wisps of clouds into the heavens itself. I felt like one of those little boulders. I knew much of what I had packed would have to remain at base camp. Would only be useful down below. It would only become a burden, an unnecessary weight that would hinder my ascent to the peak, this peak that literally reached up into the heavens. My earthly journeys through wilderness has taught me many lessons that I have found useful in my spiritual ascent. I learned very early on that creature comforts are a burden. They weigh some, and you got to carry them. And the blessings of creature comforts diminish in direct proportion to their weight. That was a lesson I learned in the first week of a 3,000-mile walk that my first wife and I were on. The pack we started out with was significantly heavier than the 65 pounds it ended up being. Garbage cans were filled with amazing amounts of technology, mostly coffee makers. But there was a more essential lesson that was taught to me in the over 10 years I've spent in wilderness, not including the time out here on the plains. As a young man, I was in continual turmoil. I was always fighting, and I'm not talking about only with fists. My entire existence was a battle. It was the nature of my life. That's why so many of us wanted peace back in the 60s. Growing up in New York City was a continual battle. Every day I would have to get up and fight to get on subways. I had to fight to avoid the troglodytes that lived in that filthy, foul-smelling nether region. If I was in a vehicle, I had to fight thousands of other cars to get off at the right exit from the left lane. I don't know exactly why I'm always in the left lane when I got to get off, but I am. I went to live in the mountains to escape this continual conflict, to find peace, to live deliberately, as the existential philosopher David Thoreau declared. His words affected my soul quite early when the education system in the United States required that people actually read. The problem was the conflict of my previous existence was now a part of me. So no matter where I was not at peace. Didn't matter the surroundings. Because peace is not an external condition. Peace is an internal condition. And what I learned during my time in the mountain was a simple yet very essential fact. I spent the better part of a decade in that valley, and during that time, the silence leached the noise that had accumulated in my soul. And the peace of that place, with all of its ruggedness, there was a serenity to it, and that leached the turmoil and the tumult from my soul. And as those aspects of my previous life diminished, I came to realize you can't fight the mountain. You have to learn to live with the mountain. No matter your resolve, if you fight, you will be dashed against the rocks. The mountain was here before you. The mountain will be here after you. If you fight that mountain, you will lose. And you'll be buried on that mountain and become part of it. The mountain has everything you need to survive. You just need to learn where it is and how to extract it. It's there. This lesson, in fact, the mountain has a Torah, a set of instructions that have to be studied and implemented if you're going to survive. That's what Torah means, instructions. This lesson has served me rather well as I have wandered mountains, deserts, across the plains now. The freedom to wander comes with rules that have to be followed, or you're not going to wander long. In similar fashion, my quest to behold the face of God is accompanied by a set of rules, instructions, laws, whatever you want to call them, it doesn't matter. It's Torah. Torah comes from the same root, more, as moreh, teacher. Paul makes the little pun on the word. The Torah was my moreh. The Torah, the law, was my schoolmaster. God has given us a Torah, a set of instructions, and if you fight against them, the only thing you'll succeed in doing is to hinder your progress on that path. The rules are there to make the journey easier, to make the journey more pleasant, to prepare you, to help you avoid conflict, injury, even death sometimes. Idi Amin comes to mind. When our people were captured by terrorists being held at Entebbe, Idi Amin provided, from the grace of his heart, food for our people. The secular Jews ate. The Orthodox Jews would not. It's not kosher. The secular Jews got real sick because from the grace of his heart, he gave them the meat that was spoiled that they were going to throw out anyway. They all got sick. The Jews who would not eat because it wasn't kosher never did find their bellies in that kind of tumult. The rules that governed my earthly journeys through the wilderness actually became a joy to follow, things I wanted to learn. There was power in knowing that wherever I was, I could live. I could find water, food, and I could make my shelter. There's a power in that. I remember the joy I had when it finally clicked and I knew how to read signs to tell if I had broke trail, which animal had made that trail, which direction they were traveling, how long it had been before that animal had made that trail. To know which plant would bring me nourishment and where to find that precious chamomile, so cleverly disguised as its name would imply, chamomile. I see God's Torah through the lens of these experiences. God's Torah, his instructions, are not a burden. They're certainly not a hindrance to joy or happiness. They illuminate the path I want to travel. They are the path I desire to travel. They nourish my soul on that journey. They prepare me to meet the one who lives at the end of that road. They are the light in which I see light. They are a beacon in the darkness that if followed, they will bring me to the source of that light, the face of God, the place I've always wanted to see. Simchat Torah, the joy of instructions. In joy does strength reside. It's all about attitude. How you see something determines whether or not it will be joy to you or sadness. I lived for over 15 years of my life in tents and loved every second of it, except that one time in the blizzard. I loved it because that's where I wanted to be. If I was forced to live 15 years in tents, I might not love it so much. Your attitude towards something is everything. That's why the joy of the Lord is your strength. However, the joy of God's Torah is not an end. It's a means toward an end. It is the path that leads to the face of God. Simchat Torah falls on the Levitical holy day of Shmini Atzeret, which is the eighth assembly. And this appointed time, this Moed, immediately follows the feast of Sukkot. 7 days you are to live in tents. The eighth day, Shmini Atzeret, is its own holy day. It has its own set of sacrifices, its own liturgy in the temple. Sukkot, when viewed from a prophetic paradigm, is the time of the thousand-year reign of Mashiach, the day of the Lord, when all the nations of the earth will bring their glory into Jerusalem before the king, and they will do so on Sukkot, or they will get no rain. It cannot be more clear of the prophetic significance of Sukkot. But again, this time is not the end. It's not the goal. Sukkot is still in the realm of time. And although it is a realm where the spiritual and the mundane swirl together, Mashiach is reigning from Jerusalem. Heaven and earth are touching and swirls together during this time of Sukkot. What it is, moreover, is a time of transition from Olam Hazeh, this world, to Olam Haba, the world to come, where people are being transformed. The earth is certainly renewed during this time, but this time has a beginning, and it has an end. It is bracketed. It is distinct. It lasts for 1,000 years. I think eternity would be a bit longer. What comes after Sukkot is utterly sublime, beyond what we can understand from the similes and the metaphors of the prophets, who are describing things, trying to describe things, that are indescribable, using phrases like transparent gold. I have no idea what that means. I've seen gold. It's not transparent. It's not even translucent. What comes after Sukkot and what is represented by Shmini Atzeret is a time when this heaven and this earth pass away and a new heaven and a new earth descend from the lofty place where the seraphim hover. Indescribable. Nothing in our existence relates to those things. It is the place where we will find the rewards for following the path laid out by God's Torah. You know, weeks are cyclic. There's 7 days in a week. The eighth day is called by the same name as the first day. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Shabbat. Then what? Sunday. We start all over again. It's very similar to an octave, a musical scale. You have, and for those who are about to pick nit, I understand there are 12 notes, but they're represented by 7 letters. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. See, everybody finishes it. Why? Because the G is a leading note. There's no resolve there. You can't leave it there or you'll fall over. It's 7 notes, which is resolved by the eighth. Shmini Atzeret. It's called by the same name, but it's not the same note. Different frequency. It is a multiple of that original frequency. If you have 440A, which is a note that has 440 cycles, an octave above that would have 880 cycles. It's the same note, but not really. Different frequency. This is precisely how our people see Shmini Atzeret. The eighth day will be like the first day. Olam Haba, the world to come, will be very similar to Gan Eden, where we bask in the fullness of God's presence, in that light, with everything that we have need of there, available, where there is rest, where there is peace, where there is no end of the day. It lasts for eternity. To be more precise, Olam Haba is when we re-enter the eternal condition we were in Gan Eden during Shabbat, when God ceased from all of his work. Our sages tell us that all the prophets of the Tanakh spoke only of the Messianic kingdom, the 1,000-year reign, of Olam Haba, the 8th day, no man knows. No man has seen. In the new covenant. And that is true right up to Revelation chapter 21. The entire book of Revelation can be found in the prophets of Tanakh. All the information. Revelation 21 and 22. Yeshua shows one of his disciples what comes after his kingdom. He shows us what none of the other prophets have seen. How many prophets have wished to see? And righteous men wish to hear these things and have not. Yeshua gives wisdom, a vision to his disciple of what comes after the Sukkot, the 1,000-year reign, the day that exists an octave above, if you will. If you want to, close your eyes and bask in the light of a montage from chapters 21 and 22 of the book of Revelation, where John was taken up in his spirit and shown things that were, that are, and that are to come. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there was no longer any sea within it. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of the heaven of God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the tabernacle, the sukkah of God is amongst men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them." Doesn't it just fill your soul? "And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. And he who sits on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' And he said, 'Write.'" These words are faithful. They're true. "Then he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of water of life without cost. He who overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son.' And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. And he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb in the middle of the street. And on either side of the river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruits, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the trees were for the healing of the nations. And there will no longer be any curse." Which curse? Curse in the garden when the man ate. And the man and creation was cursed for the sake of the man. "And the throne of God and the Lamb will be in it, and his bondservants will serve him. And they will see his face." Long before I ever read these words, my soul sought that face. It's not a head knowledge. The knowledge of this place, of that face, exists in the deepest recesses of your soul. Your soul remembers that place. It began in that place. It was breathed out of God into you. this body, this vessel that holds that soul, began in mama's womb. But the soul, that began in the mouth of God. And it remembers. Shmini Atzeret is the moment Olam Hazeh, this world ends. And with one step, the passing of a single moment, we leave time and we are immersed in eternity. It is the day we behold the face of God. Blessed is he who reads the words of this prophecy and the one who follows the path that leads to this mountaintop. For there he will find rest. There he will find peace. There he will find Mikor Chaim, the fountainhead of life. Father, in Yeshua's name, we give praise, honor, and glory to you. And thank you for the great hope that we have, that at some point in time, time will end. And the soul that was first breathed into this body will return to the one who breathed it in. And on that day we shall behold your face and rejoice for the rest of eternity that we were called by your name, O Lord God of hosts. B'Shem Yeshua, Amen.